I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be with us this week. Tonight I have with us the third segment of our early detection prevention series, Detect Illness Before It Happens. We have with us Kenneth French of Athrotech Labs, and we're going to talk about what Athrotech has to offer and actually what they've done for me, what I've been able to use for my own health, because everybody knows that I had a heart attack a couple of years ago, and how I've used this test to bring my health back around, and how I shocked myself by doing something I shouldn't do on my diet that I didn't know I was doing, and how this test saved me. So welcome, Mr. French, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us and for your company allowing you to participate in this series.
Well, thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you and your audience.
So before we get started, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you? I'd like to know a little bit about your background and about your company and where people can find your company.
Sure. I've been with Athrotech for 14 years now, and that, while that sounds like a long time to some people to be with one company, it's actually about as long as the field of lipidology has really started to really explode. 14 years ago, there wasn't an organization that looked at lipids comprehensively or collectively. There was a small group out of Florida. So when my company started, it was sort of at the new cutting edge, if you will, and we're just still on that cutting edge. So Athrotech's been around since the mid-90s, and it was acquired by a group of investors in 1999, and I started working there in 2000. And it has a technology called the VAP test. And so when I joined in, I came out of research at UAB studying proteins, HIV, and a virus that infects salmonella called P22. So my specialty was understanding the technologies and how we look at different modalities, whether it's proteins or fats or lipids, et cetera. So I came to work with Athrotech, and then since that time, I serve on the scientific arm. My job as a medical science consultant is to go out into the communities, interact and engage with different physicians at various levels, and help them understand exactly how to use our technology, the VAP test, and how to manage patients accordingly. So Athrotech is based in Birmingham, Alabama, and of course you can certainly learn a lot of information using our website, which is www.athrotech.com.
Now, just to ask you this before we get started, will insurance pay for this test? Average insurance?
Yes, ma'am. I mean, the easiest example to go with, because it's universally known, and that's Medicare. Medicare pays for the test, absolutely, as long as it meets medical necessity, which is some form of hyperlipidemia. That your physician would be reviewing you according to that diagnosis, and of course, yes, many of the payers across the United States cover this test. In fact, Athrotech Lab, we're the only lab that runs the VAP test, but many major large laboratories also send, so if your physician orders it through one of the major labs and he wants or she wants a VAP test, it would come to us in Birmingham, and we would run it accordingly, but then that lab would bill the insurance accordingly. But it is a very well-accepted test across the U.S., that's correct.
And for someone who didn't have Medicare and they have to pay some out-of-pocket, how affordable is it?
Well, it depends on where you get it. If you interact with Athrotech corporate, so in other words, let's say your physician has an account with Athrotech and they order it from us directly, and you did not have insurance, the test we're going to be talking about today would cost $39.
So affordable.
Mm-hmm.
So affordable.
It
really is. And so now that we know what it costs, let's talk about how important it is. Let me just preface this. We are not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone. The information that we're providing on this show tonight is for informational purposes only, and you must work with your doctor using information that you learn, okay? So now that we've said that, I've done multiple VAP tests with you. My heart attack was in September of 2011, and I've done multiple tests since, and we could see kind of where I started out and what happened along the way, and then what happened this year in January when I started using ghee. I was using some Ayurvedic recommendation and using a lot of ghee, and man, if I hadn't had this test, I'd probably had another heart attack out of nowhere. So where do we start? Where do you want to start?
Well, I think if it's okay with you, starting for your audience, a good place to start was this, where are we with diagnostics today when it comes to identifying risk factors for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, or even stroke events? So if you don't mind, I'd like
that
to
works
sort of,
for me.
I'd like to take a good. I'd like to take a trip down memory lane. One of the interesting phenomena that I get to witness in various circles is the phenomena of why do we still have a prevalence of a disease state where we know so much about it? Why is it still the reigning killer of men and women in the United States? And this is not to make light of the other disorders, but you know, it's understood that anywhere from 1 in 2, even 1 in 3 men or women die from cardiovascular disease, strokes, and vascular-related complications. But when you think about, for example, another very well-known disease, which is breast cancer, 1 in 30 women die from that one. And the odd thing about that is, if you think about the evolution of cancer detection, how we look at it, how we go looking for markers, looking for risk factors, that's evolved quite rapidly, I would say, in the last 10, 15, 20 years. However, when you go back and ask the question, well, what diagnostic tool are we using to determine who's at risk for cardiovascular disease? That test was developed in 1972, and it's never once changed. So think about that. I mean, you think about anything in medicine. It doesn't matter what branch of medicine or what type of philosophy you bring to the table. Think about anything that you use to determine someone's risk. And then ask yourself, does that modality change over time? In other words, does it improve? You know, I've had simple examples like a stethoscope or, you know, people talk about x-rays. All of these modalities have changed. We use them in different ways. We use less radiation. We can bring the images and make them brighter. We can take pictures as that image comes to fruition. We can see different aspects that we never could see before. But when you think about cardiovascular disease, the original formula, the original basic cholesterol test that we used was developed in 1972, and it was looking for a very specific type of patient. It was looking for patients with familial and heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia. Now, fast forward 40 years later and ask yourself, is it the failure of medication or is it the failure of the test to determine who's at greatest risk? And we at Athertech, being a laboratory, we naturally assent to the laboratory or the diagnostics is the failure, because if so many people, Eva, were considered normal, then why did all of these people go on to have heart attacks and strokes? So there's something not normal there, and that's, you know, part of what we do is we bring the lipid picture to the story and try to explain to physicians why someone who has, quote, a normal LDL and a normal HDL and triglyceride level goes on to have a traumatic event. And there's so many other hidden risk factors that are outlined so clearly in so many of the major guidelines, but unfortunately, the regular testing doesn't live up to the expectation that we need it to live up to. And I'll say this on the inset, on the outset here. One of the major limitations that your audience needs to be very careful with when they go to their physician and get the regular lipid test is this is a formula that historically puts the patient in a fasting state in order to remove dietary sources of triglycerides, and then it takes that fasting triglyceride and divides that by 5 simply to try to estimate a variable so that it can put it in the formula to try to estimate the LDL. Now, whether your philosophy is, you know, LDL is a risk factor or not, that's not being debated here. What's actually, you know, needs to be understood here is, if you track or you follow that LDL that's being estimated by the Friedewald, you must realize that that formula has several flaws, and there's 3 major flaws that I want to bring up to you and your audience. One is you have to fast for this. That's an unusual request, because why would you want to fast when the non-fasting state is the state in which you live in 18 out of the 24 hours of the day? So in other words, how your body reacts to the environment, how your body reacts to your food, to the, you know, different environmental influences that take, you know, take place in you every day. That's where you want to see how your body reacts. And the greater the reactivity, generally speaking, the greater your risk for any disease state. So what's nice about the VAP is it can be done in a non-fasting state, which tells us where do you live 18 out of 24 hours a day? How is your body in that state, in that postprandial state? And then the second thing is triglycerides. Most of your audience and many of the clinicians who use this regular basic cholesterol test are familiar with the fact that you're not allowed to use it when your triglycerides exceed 400. And that's a well-understood category. However, what most people don't realize is there's significant flaws. Even when your triglycerides are considered normal, 100 to 150, and then 150 to 200, then 200 or above. There was a study done out of Johns Hopkins, independent of Athertate, that looked at 1.3 million patients, and it asked the question, how many times when we try to estimate levels at or below 100 or at or below 70 LDL, how many of these people are not achieved or, you know, mathematically are not where we think they are? And up to 60% of those people did not achieve, quote, the LDL level when you compared the estimate to a direct measurement on the VAP test. So that's number two. You know, fasting is required for the basic test. It's not for a VAP. Go ahead.
Before you go further, just for my listening audience, okay, could you just clarify for a moment LDL and HDL to make sure that everybody understands what you're talking about when you say that, because you take it for granted and some people don't know.
No, sure. No, that's a fair question. I mean, you know, classically and historically speaking, LDL is the primary target of therapy for most major guidelines when they're trying to reduce someone's cardiovascular risk. You see that writ large in major guidelines such as endocrinology, cardiology guidelines, the diabetes guidelines, et cetera. So LDL is the primary target. You know, historically, LDL is considered, quote, the bad cholesterol, only in the sense that it is LDL that ultimately invades the endothelium and causes the plaque burden to be laid down and subsequently put the atheroma growth. And if that atheroma were to rupture, that plaque in the artery were to rupture, there's your heart attack or your stroke. So LDL is that target of therapy when you're trying to reduce someone's CVD risk. Now, HDL, on the other hand, everybody thinks that HDL is the good guy, and indeed it is, in the sense that it's taking the opportunity to try to remove cholesterol that's in an area of the body where it's not supposed to be. So that's where you hear the classic term reverse cholesterol transport. That's what HDL's job is. So in a setting where LDL is too high, or in a setting where LDLs are the wrong type, which we'll get into when we talk about the VAP, any sense where cholesterol is of the wrong type or the wrong nature, it's making its way across the endothelium, that sets up an atherogenic scenario. In other words, a heart disease or a stroke, you know, disease-causing scenario. And, of course, HDL is in the background the whole time battling, trying to reverse that and remove the excess or where the plaque or the, you know, cholesterol is at out of that area.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to make sure everybody was could follow what you're trying to tell them.
And I appreciate, you know, you getting the clarification, because this is an important point here. This, remember, it affects more of your listening audience than any other disease state you can mention. And it does it in very adverse and very traumatic ways. And so, again, to get back to the original concern, which was, you know, the basic test requires fasting, and then the LDL, when we think we're trying to estimate levels with just mildly elevated triglycerides, we're not getting true numbers. So any clinician out there is now beginning to manage a patient with a value that's not accurate because of the limitations of that mathematical limitations of Friedewald, which is that formula that estimates the LDL, which is that basic cholesterol test. And then the last category, which is probably the most, you know, the most difficult category to describe, and that, you know, conventional medicine currently recommends treating people to lower levels of LDL, given the number of risk factors, to try to offset CVD risk. Now, whether you agree or disagree, again, that's not something I'm here to debate. But I am here to make sure that as clinicians treat their patients, if they're treating levels of LDL below 100 or below 70, they need to be very, very familiar with the fact that the Friedewald formula mathematically didn't contain people with LDLs less than 70, and only 3% had an LDL less than 100. So what's happening we're making an assumption that this formula works across a whole wide variety of LDL levels, when in fact it doesn't. And so, again, when we think we're pushing people to these lower levels to try to offset some CVD risk or some risk for this individual, and we think we've achieved some numerical goal for this person, in fact, what the Johns Hopkins group showed in 1.3 million patients is the vast majority of the time we're not. So, again, I don't think it's the failure of medications, whether that medication be one of pharmaceutical domain or, you know, more homeopathic and natural in domain. The failure is when you mischaracterize risk first. In other words, when you misidentify a risk because you're getting false numbers, falsely low numbers or falsely high numbers, there's where the mistake happens. Then anything that proceeds from that, whatever therapy, whether it be dietary, lifestyle, nutraceuticals, or pharmaceuticals, then you're basically making sort of a shot in the dark. And that's the danger. We need to make sure that if the medications or the nutraceuticals that we take are as good as we think they are, we need to make sure that we're starting with accurate numbers to begin with. So I hope that sort of sheds some light on why I believe cardiovascular disease remains the number one killer. The people who most dramatically need the most intervention are the ones who are quite often underdiagnosed or misidentified because of the estimation problem with the basic cholesterol test.
That's a very important description. Thank you so much. I don't believe I've ever heard it that way from anybody else before, and it certainly makes a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to ask you a lot of questions tonight because I know you have a lot to say, and I don't want to sidetrack you from what's really important for my listening audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to let you go until I have a question, if that's okay with you. I know that's what we talked about before. Does that work for you?
That works for me, so I'd be more than happy to entertain any concerns or questions or clarifications. So please stop me if you feel like I need to clarify something further. So now that I've sort of painted the picture of the limitations of the Friedewald, which is the basic cholesterol test that gets used probably hundreds of millions of times a year in the United States, because if it's not the most ordered test in the U.S., it's probably the second most ordered test in the U.S. So, again, if cardiovascular disease affected 1 in 1 million or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100 patients, then it wouldn't be such a big deal. But since it affects everyone, literally 1 out of 2 people will have some form of vascular complication that will wreak havoc in their life. And, of course, the mortality, morbidity, and the expense of that is quite great. So you can imagine Anthrotec, when it came on the scene, recognizing, you know, the severe mathematical limitations of Friedewald. But it's just LDL alone doesn't explain the story, because historically, even, you know, researchers that were using more sophisticated modalities and getting accurate numbers of LDL, they were recognizing we're managing people, whether it's homeopathic, whether it's natural medicine, whether it's, you know, pharmaceuticals. They're managing people, and they're getting some reduction, but despite being managed, they go on to have a cardiovascular event, whether that be cerebral vascular, you know, coronary vascular, kidneys, neuropathy, peripheral vascular, you name it, they're still going on to see progression of disease. So obviously, in the face of Western medicine, obviously, you know, just looking at LDL and managing LDL alone isn't enough. So the VAP test, if you've ever had the opportunity to look at one, you'll see quite readily there's just more than 4 numbers. There's actually 22 separate reported values on a VAP test. And what's interesting about this is this is beginning to poke holes in what are some of the issues, what are some of the things that we see that are beginning to cause problems with the cardiovascular disease process that's allowing the disease to progress despite the fact that we think we're treating these people to goal or treating their numbers to goal. So a VAP test, again, comes back. It uses a patented ultracentrifugation process whereby we spin the sample at a very high speed spin at 65,000 RPMs and 47 minutes. And what this does, this process separates these lipoproteins by their characteristic densities. So what that means is we can actually physically separate HDL from a lipoprotein called Lp(a), which we'll talk about, from LDL, from another lipoprotein called intermediate density lipoprotein, and then the last one being VLDL, the very low density lipoprotein. We can separate all of these from each other, and then we can actually see some of the subclasses within each group. And then the interesting thing is, and within the last, I would say, decade or more, a lot of literature has surfaced to the tune of hundreds, maybe even thousands, that have began to look at some of these other entities and recognize very quickly that these have a lot of explanatory power, why a person with an LDL, quote, that's considered normal, eating a normal healthy diet, no smoking, no hypertension, no real significant family history, all of a sudden the person's out mowing the grass and they kill over from a large, you know, coronary left main plaque stenosis. Why did that happen? And so the question becomes, what are these different entities that we can look at? So when you look at a VAP, there's three distinct sections that we're going to talk about. There's a cholesterol section, which we'll give some detail, and what does it mean and how is it attributed to risk. Then there's a triglyceride section, and then there's a hereditary risk or a hereditary predisposition. The cholesterol section is kind of the easiest one to discuss, because when you look at familial hypercholesterolemia, homozygous or even heterozygous familial, these are people with LDL levels, 200, 300, 400, even 600, 700, 800, very high LDL levels. And so, of course, in these individuals who have that genetic predisposition from a variety of different causes, you even see people, you know, teenagers having major coronary events in their teenage years. So it's very, very troublesome. So that's a very, you know, small group of people, but it's a very obvious group. But that cholesterol, you know, domain is one part of three. And this is the one, unfortunately, that the large majority of Western medicine focuses on. And it leaves the other two, the triglyceride domain and the hereditary domain, it leaves those other two sort of off to the side, thinking, well, we can't do anything, or there's not really data there to support doing something there, so we're just going to leave it alone. And I think that's one of the things that Athletech, we spend a lot of time educating our clinicians and our clients on, because we have to help them realize that LDL is only one portion of the story. So when I move into the triglyceride domain, I want everybody to think back. When this formula was made in 1972, think about our population. Think about the level of activity that each of our children engaged in. There were no such thing as video games at the time. Everybody had to go out in the yard and play whatever game they wanted to play. So there was a high level of physical activity. Think about the population and the demographics back then. Think about the types of foods that everybody got to eat and how often they ate. Think about the size or the portion controls of these individual meals. Now, fast forward 40 years later, ask yourself, does anything from then represent or is recognizable today? And I think you would find the answer to most of those to be no. We have an onset and epidemic of type 2 diabetes, and that before that disease process comes, you know, to fruition, what we see before that is a state called insulin resistance. And the way right now a lot of practitioners look for insulin resistance risk factors is they look for things such as a condition called metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is a constellation of risk factors that comes together to try to help characterize those people who are at most risk for cardiovascular and diabetes risk. And there's five distinct criteria for the metabolic syndrome. There's a blood pressure. There's a glucose elevation. There's a waist circumference, visceral adiposity, the waist circumference. Then there's a triglyceride component and an HDL component. If any of the listeners, for example, have, you know, blood pressure or being treated for blood pressure, they have visceral adiposity, in other words, their waist circumference is beyond the recommended levels, and they have a fasting glucose greater than 100, for example, they have three of the five. All you have to have is three of the five to be classified as a patient with the metabolic syndrome. Now, what's interesting about the metabolic syndrome is this is a triglyceride-rich disorder. This is a disorder of insulin metabolism and glucose metabolism, rather. And what this means is people, generally speaking, people who indulge in too many simple and rich refined carbohydrates or foods that are very high in fatty substances, what happens is you cause the entire triglyceride cascade to be altered. Now, when you say triglyceride-rich and the whole triglyceride cascade to be altered, what are we talking about? Well, there's several lipoproteins at play. One's called the very low-density lipoprotein, very low-density, or VLDL. The other one is called the intermediate-density lipoprotein. And then the last one is called LDL pattern B. So I'm going to describe each one of these very quickly, but in such a way that hopefully the audience will see where I'm going with this. When you eat a diet that's high in simple enriched refined carbohydrates, whether that's in the form of liquid sugar, I used the example of sodas, or even, you know, some of the fruit drinks or sports drinks. They're very high in simple enriched refined carbohydrates. Or you eat pasta, rice, pastries. A lot of refined carbohydrate sources are very, very fatty foods. What happens is, as a result of that, anywhere from 1 to 4 hours after we eat, there's a huge influx of these triglyceride-rich particles called chylomicrons, and they're trying to deal in some way with their, what they're trying to keep all of this energy in some form. So they're going to deliver this triglyceride payload either to the fat cells for storage, or they're going to take it to some muscle tissue to be utilized. Then the remnants of that turn back to the liver. Now, this is the critical component. From the liver, our liver is very, very efficient and very capable of making all of the components that we need for, in the triglyceride tree for energy. It does this on its own, not necessarily needing the diet to do this. So the first lipoprotein that emerges from the liver is called very low-density lipoprotein, or VLDL. Now, that VLDL's job is, again, just like the original chylomicron from the diet, its job is also to deliver a triglyceride payload either to the fat cells for storage on a day when we're not eating as much as we should, or it's going to give that free fatty acids to the muscle cells for energy utilization. Now, once that happens, that converts into IDL. Now, IDL is called intermediate density lipoprotein for a reason. At this point, IDL is going to grab excess cholesterol from HDL, and it's going to turn into LDL. Now, this is the normal pathway that I'm talking about here. The problem is, when we eat too many of the refined carbohydrates, or the very, very fatty foods, what happens at this point, now the whole cascade goes in an opposite direction. Now, from the liver, we produce too many VLDL particles, or too many VLDL cholesterol particles. Well, these particles are directly atherogenic. And not only are they atherogenic, meaning they can cause atherosclerosis, but because of these high VLDL particles, it's extremely toxic to the endothelium, and there's the issue. When you go in and you damage the endothelium by high oxidative stress or by these high remnant lipoprotein particles, damaging the endothelium means now instead of having an endothelium that's very careful and very selective in what it allows in and out, a damaged endothelium is just sort of like wet tissue paper. Just about anything can pass through. And if that is at a strategic point in the arterial anatomy, whether that's a branch or at a high shear stress point coming off the aorta of your heart, you can imagine very quickly how easy it would be for the LDL particles, the LDL cholesterol-carrying particles, to penetrate the endothelial space and to oxidize and then basically lay down its cholesterol burden, which over time, if that process is not stopped, over time that creates the growth of a plaque called an atheroma. And if that plaque growth is quite rapid and very inflamed, it ruptures. And what people need to realize is you don't die from a 99% occluded vessel. Those are easy to spot because you climb a flight of stairs and you're out of breath and you're grabbing your chest from angina. That's easy to spot. The one that's hard to spot is a 40% occluded vessel that's about to blow. And if you're out playing tennis and it pops and it creates a thrombus or an instant clot across your entire coronary left main, then you die from ischemia. That would be a massive MI. So VLDL is very much involved in the whole process of creating a very corrosive environment for the endothelium, a healthy endothelium, to resist the atherogenic burden. Now, not only that, but in the people with high triglyceride-rich domain, the IDL is slightly increased. And not only that, it creates the wrong form of LDL. Now, I think I've told you earlier in our previous discussion, Diva, that I'm not necessarily a big fan of the idea that just a normal or slightly high LDL is necessarily a huge risk. I think the data has shown that throughout, you know, different population groups throughout the world, that a high LDL by itself doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a heart attack. There's plenty of examples of people who die in their 90s in their sleep from natural causes who have an LDL of 170, okay? And there's also, however, plenty of examples of people who die running, you know, their usual 5-3 mile run, healthy as a horse, with an LDL less than 70. So the amount of LDL doesn't necessarily help us there, but the type of LDL definitely does. And that type of LDL that our body wants to have, we call it pattern A. This is, when you look up literature, you'll see pattern A or large buoyant LDL. This is the preferred biological form that our body wants to see our LDL emerge as. However, there's a problem. When the triglyceride domain begins to emerge because of our dietary and lifestyle changes that we've seen today in 2014 with all the simple enriched carbohydrates, lack of exercise, weight gain, blood pressure issues, glucose issues, when that whole triglyceride cascade begins to emerge, instead of the LDL falling down to a large, buoyant pattern A form that's recognized very easily by our liver, very less oxidized, in the endothelium, when that triglyceride cascade emerges, now what we see is small dense LDL, pattern B particles. So to give you an analogy that I think would help you, think of 100 people getting on a school bus. That's one large vehicle carrying 100 people. Well, think of that as one large particle, LDL pattern A particle, carrying 100 units of cholesterol. Now, I could take each one of those individuals off the bus and put them in each one have their own Mini Cooper. So now the particles are smaller, so I've got one vehicle carrying one unit of cholesterol, so look how many more vehicles I have. Instead of having one, now I have 100. So the cholesterol level, if you noticed in both of those examples, the cholesterol level is the same. It's 100 milligrams per deciliter, which would be, you know, considered normal or optimal by just about any standard. But the number of particles carrying the cholesterol in example one was one, but in the other it was 100, so 100-fold more. So that's why one of the reasons why pattern B is so detrimental. There's more of them, therefore, if there's an injury in the endothelial space, instead of one particle hitting that spot and maybe bouncing off and leaving and not creating a plaque or the growth of a plaque, now I have 100 times more hitting that same spot. So there's the significant risk. And not only that, pattern B carries another several risks in several different areas. Pattern B compared to pattern A, so if I took one particle of pattern A and I put it on the table here, and I took another pattern B LDL particle and put it right next to it, are there differences in those two particles other than the overall size? And the answer is yes. Pattern Bs are much highly oxidized more readily than pattern A, for example. Pattern B sticks to the proteoglycans, the internal matrix of the endothelium, much more readily than pattern A does. And not only that, remember I said pattern A is the form that our body recognizes. So when pattern A comes through to the liver, the LDL receptors in the liver can very easily attach to that pattern A LDL and remove it from circulation. However, 30 to 40% of the pattern B particles that go into the liver, guess what? They are allowed to reemerge back out into circulation. So if you've read, and there's several pieces of literature that talk about LDL pattern B being 3 to 4 times more atherogenic than pattern A, and one of the rationales behind that is because there's a longer residence time, and that's the last thing we want to do, is to keep a potentially atherogenic particle in the system longer than it was designed to be there. Because the longer you leave something, you know, if you have something that's in your body that has a biological age of 3 days or 7 days, but it's in there for 15 days, you can already imagine that that particle is becoming damaged, it's becoming highly oxidized, it's becoming, if you will, mutated in such a way that now anything it touches or comes in contact with is going to damage. So that's the result. And this is the triglyceride, which, you know, people think, well, yeah, that's easy to spot. When trigs are over 200, 400, 500, those, we can see all those people. No, no, no. Half the people in the United States with triglyceride levels less than 150, which is the optimal level, less than 150, half of those people have the pattern B particle, okay? And this leads to increased LDL particle concentration. So so you just went from a million LDL particles to a billion. By simply changing the particle size, you have more concentration of particles in circulation. Therefore, the greater chance of the growth of an atheroma is significantly higher. And all of this, Eva, all of this stems from a triglyceride disorder or triglyceride-rich disorder. You know, people ask me all the time, well, what's a normal triglyceride? And if you look at the literature, a normal, you know, 10th percentile triglyceride is 40 plus or minus 70. So in a fasting state, your trigs should easily be below 70. So, you know, if your listening audience is hearing anything here, they need to be going back and looking at their triglycerides and asking the question, do I have that normal fasting triglyceride? Because if I don't, or my triglycerides are hovering around that 120, 150, 180 range, I may be producing these small dense LDL particles. And if I am, then I'm at significantly higher risk not only for cardiovascular disease, but this may be one of the precursor signs that I'm at risk for type 2 diabetes.
So I just want to keep you on track here.
Sure.
We have about 17 minutes.
Okay. I can honor that.
So just keep going because you're fabulous. Just keep going.
Sure. So that, and I guess you can see that even with what I had to say, I think most clinicians are very comfortable with LDL. I think they're very comfortable with treating it if they have a philosophy that they believe is lower is better, or they understand that LDL is not necessarily a huge risk in and of itself. But if you noticed, I'm drawing a lot of weight towards the triglyceride domain because this is the risk factor of the future. It's been the risk, and the reason why it's the risk factor of the future is because 40 years ago, it wasn't a problem. Most people were at weight. They didn't have significant obesity issues, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, or diabetes. Diabetes in the 60s and 70s was considered a disease of age. Now we're diagnosing children with type 2 diabetes as early as 9 and 8 years old. So there is significant concern and reason why triglycerides, I think, are going to rapidly become at the forefront of cardiovascular risk reduction, is understanding how these triglycerides are causing the entire lipid cascade, cholesterol cascade, to go in a direction that it was never designed to go in. Now, the last one, and it's kind of the spookiest one, because we can do something about cholesterol with diet and lifestyle, and we can do something about the triglyceride domain with our diet and lifestyle and nutraceuticals, but the last one is the hereditary predisposition. So, for example, a good way to say to find out if you could be an individual who has a hereditary predisposition is to look back into your family history and ask yourself, do I have aunts, uncles, you know, grandfather, grandmothers, parents? Do I see a very early occurrence of a CVD event, meaning they had a heart attack at a premature age in their 30s, 40s, even early 50s to some extent? Do I see sudden strokes with not really any explanatory power? In other words, they didn't smoke maybe. They didn't indulge in too much alcohol. They weren't that overweight. They were always active. They were engaged with the community. They were happy. They didn't have too high of a stress. If all of a sudden you have examples of that in your family history, if it's not a coagulation disorder like prothrombin or Leiden where you see actual coagulation, blood clotting disorders, if it's not a coagulation disorder, chances are it's a lipoprotein called LP and in parentheses little a. And that is a lowercase a, so that's why I pronounce it as LP little a. LP little a is a lipoprotein that the amount of LP little a that's in your body was genetically determined. So by the time you're a neonate of 6 months, you are producing the quantities of LPA at the adult level, and you carry that with you for the rest of your life. And I'm going to make a special clause here for women who go through menopause. There's something to be extra careful with when we talk about LP little a. But LP little a is one of those lipoproteins that mimics a very important protein in our body called plasminogen. And if you know anything about plasminogen, you need to just at least know this part. Plasminogen is involved in the body with having to do with the viscosity of the blood or how well our body clots. So if there's lots of fibrin activity in the body, plasminogen will bind to its receptors and help break down some of that fibrin. So it's in the balance of the blood viscosity. Now, here's the issue. The protein found on the shell or the surface of Apolittle A is actually mimics plasminogen. The problem is when Apolittle A is believed, when it binds to plasminogen receptors, there's no breakdown of the fibrin. So you can essentially see that LPA actually is creating a hypercoagulable state, such that if you had a small lesion in your coronary left main or in the carotid or in your cerebral vascular network where all of a sudden you had a small rupture, or in a normal person, that may be actually sealed off and fixed with real no significant ischemic event or even consequence. You may not even know it happened. But in a person with high LPA, because of that hypercoagulable state, that small rupture occurs, there's an instant thrombus. In other words, there's an instant shutoff of blood supply at that spot because the lumen just got occluded by a large clot, and as a result, anything downstream dies from ischemia. There's your heart attack. There's your stroke. So, and that's why it's called the heart attack protein. And in some circles, people have referred to it as the widowmaker or the widower maker, because it just is so sudden in its presentation. Now, one of the reasons why I brought up women is because women, when they're born, of course, they're not menstruating, so their estrogen and progesterone levels are different. Then when they go through their puberty stages, the estrogen levels naturally begin to increase. But what's interesting is estrogen in these women, it actually suppresses the amount of LPA that you have. However, when do you think there's a risk for women? Well, when they go through their perimenopausal and menopausal years, guess what happens? That estrogen begins to, if you will, the ovaries are shutting down, the estrogen levels drop. But guess what goes back to its pre-adolescent baseline? That's Lp(a). And this is one of the reasons why women, much more so than men, women don't tend to survive their heart attacks as often as men do. That's number one. And number two, women are not treated at the same cardiovascular, I mean, it's assumed that men and women have the same cardiovascular risk once a woman goes through menopause. That's false. I think that's been demonstrated numerous times with several very, very good peer-reviewed journals. But LPA may be one of those major culprits as to why women, during their peri- and postmenopausal years, they need to be paying close attention, because if all of a sudden you begin to see that LPA go up, then you ask very pointed questions to the patient, and you ask, or the patient needs to examine themselves and say, do I have women in my family that when they were going through their perimenopausal, menopausal years, that had a sudden event from a stroke or a heart attack? If the answer to that is yes, then you want that to be evaluated, and then you want to, of course, take, the proper protocols to try to offset or reduce that risk.
I have two questions here. I just want to make sure I understand, that my listeners understand. So basically you're saying one of the things to control this is your hormones. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Hormones have a very known effect on lipoprotein,
okay.
Little a. That's right.
And what would you want that number to be? If you could pick a number, what would be the best number?
For Lp(a)?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, there's several ways of measuring. On a VAP test, you'd want the level of Lp(a) to be less than 10 milligrams per deciliter of cholesterol. Now, if you use an amino assay, there's a reference range of 75 nanomoles per liter. That's the equivalent percentile as the 10 milligrams per deciliter of cholesterol. So it's a different way of measuring it, but they're coming to the same conclusion.
Okay. And is that the only thing that makes it fluctuate? Are there other things that can fluctuate that particle?
Yeah. Or the LPA, yes, ma'am. I mean, to your point, traditionally, one of the interesting things about LPA is it's not under very, in other words, you can go out and change the way you eat and change your LDL tomorrow. You can go out and change the way you eat and change your triglyceride and all the triglyceride-rich lipoproteins, a lot of them, tomorrow. But you can't go out and change the way you eat and change your LPA, traditionally speaking. Now, I've got to be careful. There's always an exception to the rule, but as a general rule, LPA is not one of those things that you can eat your way to a better Lp(a) level. Like losing weight, for example, that doesn't necessarily lower Lp(a), or eating a less fatty-rich diet, that doesn't necessarily change LPA. There are certain physiologic circumstances where LPA can go up or go down, and we've seen that, for example, people who drink moderate amounts of alcohol, LPA goes down. But if they stop drinking, you can see it go up. So it's one of those things that if you're doing, ethanol and you decide to stop, you want to watch your LPA. Because if it goes up, then you just want to know that could be a potential risk. Other things that have been, seen, again, other than the menopause of women, alcohol, we've seen people on aspirin therapy. There can be some fluctuations, so you want to watch that. People with hypothyroidism, this would be underactive thyroids. We've seen people that have modulations in Lp(a) as well as people with renal disease. So people, in other words, as their renals become compromised, LPA goes up.
So that was another something I wanted to ask you from the very beginning, because I've had three people this week ask me about kidneys.
Uh-huh.
How does, and I don't want to take up all your time, but I would like to know, how do you know what's affecting your kidneys if it's cholesterol related? Let's assume that it is, okay? And then how do you support those kidneys if it's cholesterol related?
Wow. Well, that's fair. I mean, so you take the major risk factors for kidney disease, and let's keep this to your point quick and very easily. But high blood pressure is the biggest one. So if you have labile hypertension, which is the one that's the sneakiest one, that's the one that's induced by stress, but when you go and see your doctor and you're not stressed out, they don't pick it up. So that's why it's important to always get your blood pressure in the heat of battle. Get your blood pressure cuff, go to a local, pharmacy store and get your blood pressure. If you see that you're a stress-induced hypertensive, that's one thing you want to control. The next one, the big risk factor, of course, is certainly smoking. And then the last one, to your point, if you have the abnormalities that are very high cholesterol levels or particularly those triglyceride-rich lipoproteins we spoke about or even LPA, you start seeing changes in LPA, then certainly, the thing to do is to listen to the clinician, certainly get on a diet that's high in oxidative, antioxidant capacity, diets that, limit the amount of carcinogens or chemicals that come from, like, smoking or, that kind of thing, like barbecues. In other words, as close to the ground as you can get it, to the closest to the tree you can get it, the better it is. And of course, if the meat's handled correctly and allowed to be in its natural state, that would be a healthy source of eating the meats. But yeah, everything we've spoken about, if you talk about kidneys, you might as well talk about the heart, because if it's affecting the microvessel network within the kidneys and the Bowman's capsule, these capillaries are so small they only let one red blood cell through at a time. If you're destroying those with any of the things that I just named, just give that 5 to 10 more years, and you'll see it in the coronary left main or in the carotids in your neck or in the cerebral vascular network or even in the peripheral artery network. In other words, kidneys are probably one of the most fascinating markers of future major vessel events that will be more traumatic in their presentation, because you can destroy half your kidneys, not even know it. But if you start seeing kidney decline, anything that I just described, that's destroying the kidneys at some level. So you want to make sure that anything that you can do that supports the kidneys, ultimately, is supporting the heart, the brain, and the rest of your arterial anatomy. Does that make sense, Eva?
Absolutely. And I just want to tell everybody, next Sunday night, we have Dr. Steven Sinatra. I'm not asking Mr. French a million questions about diet and can things be reversed and this, that, and the other, because Mr. French is the lab, and I don't want to take away from him talking about his early detection. So next week we have Dr. Steven Sinatra, and we're going to talk about what you do to fix all these things that the lab's telling us with your diet and stuff. So is there? We have about, let me see what time it is. We have about 4 minutes or so. Talk about, you're doing a great job, and I just want you to keep going if you have anything else you want to make sure you cover.
I just think I want to reemphasize, because we went through a lot on this show, and it is quite a sophisticated topic, but I think it's one that most people, when everybody knows somebody very close to them that's been affected by this, and the sad commentary is there's so much we can do to put ourselves in a position where we don't have to face this. Sometimes certain cancers are inevitable. A lot of times we can step in the place with, again, the right kind of living, but some just happen. But this one, the cardiovascular, the diabetes, and the stroke epidemic that we're faced with this country, the morbidity and the mortality and the cost to deal with that is so high that some of the stuff, and I'm actually, you're right, Dr. Sinatra is very gifted in understanding the parameters that not only our test shows, but other parameters, and how you can take a lifestyle approach to, at the very least, once you put everything that you can possibly do with the right things in place, going to the next step to the levels of supplements or pharmaceuticals, then they'll work very easily and you won't need such high amounts to control it. So, yes, get a VAP test. If you're going to make any decision to treat yourself with any chronic, medications or supplements, if you're going to, your clinician wants to do this for a lifetime, you better make sure what you're getting is accurate. And number two, you want to see underneath the major, big total LDL, HDL, and triglycerides, you want to see underneath, are there other risk factors that are pointing us to something that actually is going to hurt us later and on down the road? And start making changes now. You can actually reverse a lot of these disorders, but the key to it is detecting it and detecting it early, and I think that's the role of a lab test.
And I just want to say, I've done multiples of these tests. It would be my recommendation, just as a patient, to do it maybe every 6 months, because I can tell you my VAP tests have gone from being almost perfect to almost having a heart attack again. And if I hadn't have done this test, I wouldn't have known to rein myself back in on some things that I was doing.
Yeah,
so you know that. I wish we had more time so you could tell people how shocked I was when I thought I was so perfect, and how perfect I was when I didn't know it. So do these things so that you know what's happening. For $40 bucks, you can't beat it.
And I think, to your point, this is not one of those things where you get it checked once and you think everything's fine. I mean, there's even a seasonality. If you change the way you eat, you're going to change your lipids. And if you're changing your lipids for the worst, you're absolutely right, Eva. That starts the whole cascade. So getting
out in front
of it.
You probably saved my life. You know that? You know that. You know,
well,
when I called you to do this series. Sorry?
Well, I was hoping the test did that, but you're right. It did a lot, and it showed a lot. And the neat thing is, Eva, there's so many different things that we can do to help reverse that. But you're right. If you hadn't have caught it, who knows? Exactly,
well, I can tell you what I'm going to do. It's been almost 2 months, or right about 2 months, since we probably took that last test. I can't remember exactly.
Uh-huh.
But I've done radical things, where I'm going to do it again probably next week or the week after that, and we're going to see just exactly what we want to know, early
mm-hmm.
detection and prevention, and how much I was able to affect that test.
Yep, and
you'd excited,
be surprised.
Actually.
You will be
That's
surprised.
Great.
You have a lot of power right there in your own mind.
So tell us one more time where we can find your company and how to get this test.
Sure. It's www. And I'll spell it, Atherotech, AtherotechAtherotech.com. And, of course, if you want to contact Atherotech, that's 800-719-9807. Again, 800-719-9807. You can certainly call in and ask for some information, and our company would be glad to provide it. And if you're a clinician and you're interested in using our laboratory, we have a lot more than just a VAP, so you can certainly call in, and we can certainly send a representative to come out and visit you and show you how that works.
And I want to remind my listeners, if your doctor doesn't do this test, all you have to do is ask him or call them, and they will contact him. All you got to do is fill out some paperwork, and he can provide these tests to you. So if he doesn't do them, ask him to get the Atherotech rep out and sign up, because it really is an amazing test. Thank you so much, Mr. French, for taking time to be with us. I'm grateful and honored to have you on my show.
I feel the same way, and I appreciate you and your time. And, of course, again, happy Father's Day to all your listeners.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye.